Hello, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with the Arizona Daily Sun for Friday, May 2nd. I'm volunteer reader Julia. Front page articles include FUSD adds two electric buses to its fleet as driver staffing shortage continues. UWNA announces award winners, discusses literacy in Northern Arizona during annual luncheon, and feds mistakenly kill female Mexican gray wolf in Arizona. The first article for today is FUSD adds two electric buses to its fleet as driver staffing shortage continues. The Flagstaff Unified School District, FUSD, hosted a ribbon-cutting ceremony for two new electric buses as part of Bus Driver Appreciation Day. FUSD was awarded $790,000 to purchase the buses as part of the 2023 grant cycle for the EPA's Clean School Bus Program. The remainder of the cost, which including this grant, totals $1,039,854.49, comes from 2018 bond funds. These EPA grants are intended to remove older diesel buses from the road and replace them with electric buses. A requirement of this grant is that two of the district's current buses be destroyed. FUSD has applied for two more electric buses during the current cycle, the recipients of which will be announced in May. The district will be using its new electric buses for in-town routes, as their battery capacity allows for a range of 150 to 175 miles a day. School bus routes within Flagstaff are typically between 50 to 60 miles per day. The new buses look similar to the district's other buses, with FUSD Transportation Director Patrick Fleming saying the main difference is the way they feel to drive. Braking and decelerating both happen faster in electric vehicles, he said, and they are designed to make a noise when moving at slower speeds. Electric buses are more expensive to purchase than other kinds, though they have reduced maintenance costs. Fleming also mentioned the logistics involved in charging times. He said it would probably take at least 15 years to understand the full impact of using electric buses compared to other kinds. Electric buses don't produce emissions directly from the vehicle, though Fleming noted that the power plant used to charge them might produce emissions depending on its energy source. There's a huge benefit of students standing in a bus loading zone, not being impacted by exhaust vehicles in the loading zone, he said. That's definitely a huge difference. We are shifting any kind of emissions that may be occurring away from the loading zone so that they are not breathed in by adolescents. Currently, FUSD's fleet includes 60 diesel buses, 20 propane buses, and two new electric buses. It plans to continue using a mix of bus types, Fleming said, noting that the diesel buses currently in use are a cleaner version than previous diesel-fueled buses. FUSD's most recent purchase request from the Transportation Department was for diesel buses. Because they have the most infrastructure for refueling, diesel buses have the widest range. The range available to the electric buses would prohibit their use for trips to Phoenix, Fleming said as an example. FUSD is planning to continue replacing older vehicles with ones that have fewer emissions, he said. Bus service reductions expected to continue. FUSD is most of the way through its full year since starting the bus eligibility reductions due to an ongoing shortage of drivers. The district's total drivers is holding steady, Fleming said in late April, with a similar number to last year, though it still has fewer than its number of routes. FUSD currently employs 38 bus drivers for its 41 routes. The extra three are driven by FUSD office staff who have met state requirements but do not have bus driving as their main job. He said the changes FUSD has made in recent years have helped the transportation department keep up with the need. Those changes really have made things a lot easier for sure, he said, especially our crosstown, our magnet-type transfers. We're not as dependent on those in order to be able to leave timely from schools. FUSD is continuing to hold hiring events and outreach to try to hire more drivers. Ideally, Fleming said, he would like to hire at least 25 more drivers to return FUSD to its previous levels of bus service and eligibility. This includes people working a range of hours, from full-time drivers to part-time drivers, taking students on field trips over the weekend. For now, however, he said the reductions in routes and eligibility made since the 2023 to 2024 school year will likely continue through the upcoming school year that starts in August. No additional reductions are planned at the moment, he said. I hope not, Fleming said when asked about additional reductions. A lot is going to depend on our ability to recruit, train, and have drivers ready to go in August. FUSD will also continue to partner with Mountain Line to offer free bus passes for affected students. Mountain Line issued 733 year-round bus passes during the fall 2024 semester, compared to around 460 for the previous spring semester, when this was first offered. Additional reductions were added between the two semesters. As of the 100th day of the current school year, an average of 1,623 students are riding FUSD buses for their transportation to and from school. Fleming said the changes needed to be able to hire more drivers might need to come from outside of the district. He listed Arizona's funding of schools and Flagstaff's cost of living as current barriers. Some changes will have to come from the state level, I think. One of those changes would be better funding for schools, better funding for all positions in schools, from teachers to custodial to bus drivers and bus aides to paraprofessionals, and better affordability in Flagstaff. Fleming also noted the support of district families and Flagstaff residents more generally. Our tax base supports this district in a way that I can look around the state and see that other districts do not receive the level of support, he said, citing local voter support of district bonds as an example. As hard as it is some days to know that we don't have enough drivers for every route, I know that it's not for lack of community support. And that was the article, FUSD adds two electric buses to its fleet as driver staffing shortage continues. The next article for today is UWNA announces award winners, discusses literacy in Northern Arizona during annual luncheon. United Way of Northern Arizona, UWNA, hosted its annual Community Impact Luncheon last week, awarding local residents and organizations and discussing the state of youth literacy in the region. Northern Arizona University and Coconino Community College received the Community Builder Award, while APS received the Leading the Way Award, Joy Baking Group received the Campaign Growth Award, and Coconino County Juvenile Courts Hope Receiving Center was given the Stepping Up for Youth Award. Nathan Schott was recognized with the Helping Hands Award, and this year's Volunteer Awards went to Viviana Reyes and Bruce Blinkenship. The luncheon, which is also UWNA's annual meeting at which an update on the current fundraising campaign is included, was themed around literacy. Rima Brucey, a professor at NAU, co-chaired the annual campaign this year with her husband, NAU President Jose Luis Cruz Rivera. During the luncheon, Brucie spoke about how reading inspired her return to education. She initially dropped out of high school in 11th grade, and after returning, earned several post-secondary degrees, including a PhD in cultural anthropology from Cornell. As we consider the state of literacy in Arizona today, I ask you to remember that behind every statistic is a child whose future hangs in the balance, she said. A child who might find in books what I found. Not just knowledge, but sanctuary. Not just skills, but selfhood. Not just a path to success, but a way home. Vince Yanez, Helios Education Foundation Senior Vice President, discussed statistics about childhood education and literacy in Northern Arizona. He said that under a third of third graders in Coconino, Navajo, and Apache counties passed the statewide language arts assessment in 2024. Barriers include ongoing effects of the COVID-19 pandemic, chronic absenteeism, and a lack of access to trained literary coaches, he said. Reading and a love of learning is foundational for all our youth, said UWNA President and CEO Liz Archuleta. That's why we continue to find new ways to support our youth through programs anchored at UWNA or by providing grants to our partners throughout the region. UWNA's youth literacy efforts have recently expanded, including a literacy fair in Flagstaff, doubling local enrollment in the Dolly Parton Imagination Library, and a planned expansion of its Kinder Camp program this summer to include schools in Holbrook and Joseph City. Luncheon attendees donated books for future literary fairs and wrote encouraging messages in other books, which will be distributed to Kinder Camp students as part of the event. According to the announcement, UWNA's annual campaign has almost reached its 2024 to 2025 fiscal year goal of $1.2 million. More information can be found at nazunitedway.org. And that was the article, UWNA Announces Award Winners, Discusses Literacy in Northern Arizona During Annual Luncheon. The next article for today is Feds Mistakenly Kill Female Mexican Gray Wolf in Arizona. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service admitted it killed the wrong endangered Mexican gray wolf during a removal operation earlier this month in eastern Arizona. The government intended to kill an uncollared wolf, but instead killed a collared female wolf who may have been pregnant. Advocates for wolf conservation immediately called for an investigation into the lethal error. A Fish and Wildlife FWS spokesperson did not respond to a request for comment. On April 4th, Brady McGee, the Southwest Region Coordinator for the Mexican Wolf Recovery Program, authorized the lethal removal of one uncollared wolf from the Bear Canyon Pack, which lives in the Blue Range primitive area of the Apache Sitgreaves National Forest. The removal, McGee wrote in a memorandum, was justified by a chronic series of depredations, or killing of livestock. These included 6 confirmed wolf-caused livestock deaths over a 12-month period. In his memo, McGee wrote, "It is our intent not to remove the breeding female, wearing a non-functioning radio collar, who will likely whelp a new litter of pups soon. However, on April 14th, that wolf, designated AF-1823 and nicknamed Aziza by wolf advocates, was mistakenly lethally removed, according to a very brief statement from FWS. The agency has not explained how or why the error occurred. The actual operation was delegated to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Wildlife Services Division, a division that has been consistently criticized by conservationists who allege it operates without adequate transparency and favors the interests of ranchers and landowners. In an interview with the Arizona Daily Sun, Claire Musser, executive director of the Grand Canyon Wolves Recovery Project, said, "It is devastating every time we lose one of the wolves on the landscape. As sentient individual beings, their lives are just as important to them as mine is to me," Musser added. Mexican gray wolves were hunted to the brink of extinction in the mid-20th century and reintroduced to the wild in 1998 after a program of captive breeding. As a federally recognized endangered species, their recovery is overseen by an interagency coalition including federal, state, and tribal authorities. The latest official population data, released earlier this year, found at least 124 gray wolves living in Arizona, a number now reduced by one. "It's not wolves that are the problem. It's reactive, fear-driven policies," Musser said. She questioned how the decision to use lethal force was reached and what other measures weren't working or weren't being done effectively. "We need to be proactive before conflict occurs rather than reactive," Musser added. She emphasized the importance of range riding, the deployment of trained personnel on horseback who can patrol the areas where wolves and livestock are likely to interact, and haze wolves away from cattle as one such protective measure. The memo authorizing lethal removal claimed hazing attempts had been extremely ineffective due to the area's rugged terrain. All effective hazing has been done within the Blue River Canyon along the Blue River Road. This is the only road in the area and where the private property occurs. Attempts at hiking and or horseback riding hazing have proven to be ineffective, the memo noted. More mistakes? In a press release, Western Watersheds Project Deputy Director Greta Anderson called for accountability. "It's outrageous that our government is authorizing wolves to be killed for preying on livestock on public lands, full stop," Anderson said. "But the fact that they killed a collared mother wolf by accident is completely unacceptable. Wildlife professionals should be trained to know what they are targeting, especially when it comes to a highly imperiled species. We demand a full investigation and criminal charges for negligence, if appropriate." Musser agreed, "We have an ethical responsibility, and this should be taken seriously, and there should be an investigation. However, before any such investigation could begin, FWS announced the killing of another Mexican gray wolf. According to an April 28th statement, the adult male wolf, AM2764, was lethally removed from the Hale Canyon Pack in New Mexico on April 22nd. That operation was also justified by livestock depredation and delegated to USDA's Wildlife Services personnel. The decision memo noted that the Hale Canyon Pack, like the Bear Canyon Pack across the state line, will likely soon have new pups. AM2764 was the specific target of the Hale Canyon lethal removal operation. Between the recent killing of a pregnant female wolf and now the killing of a breeding male just before his pups are born, it's clear that federal wildlife agencies have completely lost their way and wolves are paying the ultimate price. Brian Novitsky, Southwest Deputy Director at the Center for Biological Diversity, said in a press release, "Our public lands should be places where endangered animals can recover and thrive, not be killed left and right." In a follow-up call, Novitsky said, "It is certainly alarming to see these happening in such short order. We're also not seeing that there's necessarily a lot of thought and deliberation and planning going into these authorizations for removal." Both lethal removals were likely to affect the reproductive stress of the wild population, he noted. Nowitzki said he was not certain if the pair of authorizations for lethal force might reflect changing priorities at FWS under the new presidential administration. All federal land management agencies, he acknowledged, have been put under scrutiny by President Donald Trump and targeted for varying levels of staffing and budget cuts, as well as ideological compliance with the president's agenda. For sure, the agencies are feeling that pressure, Nowitzki said, but I don't know whether and how that would be affecting any decisions yet. He also noted, though, that some opponents of wolf reintroduction, such as the county commissioners in Catron County, New Mexico, who recently declared a state of emergency based on the presence of Mexican gray wolves, have ramped up their pressure, believing that federal agencies may be more amenable to their position now. The designated reintroduction area for the Mexican gray wolf spans much of Arizona and New Mexico, with Interstate 40 as its northern boundary. Some wolves, however, have ventured north of the interstate to the area around Flagstaff. Late last year, one of two known wolves in this region was found dead east of Williams. Officials with FWS and the Arizona Game and Fish Department have not released an official cause of death in that case, though the wolf's mortality was believed to be human-caused. Another wolf was shot and killed in the same general area in January of 2022. No suspects or perpetrators have been identified in either case. And that was the article, Feds Mistakenly Kill Female Mexican Gray Wolf in Arizona. The next news article for today is Downtown Flagstaff's first Friday art walk to be car-free on May 2nd. May's first Friday art walk in downtown Flagstaff will be car-free as a special celebration of art, community, and all things multimodal, such as walking, biking, and public transit. The block of Aspen Avenue between LaRoche Street and San Francisco Street, which runs along Heritage Square, will be closed to vehicles and opened to pedestrians, bikes, and creativity. ArtX is the presenting sponsor and funding the closure. Scheduled from 5 to 9 p.m., Friday's schedule of events includes poetry readings, followed by live music from Good Luck Bad Stuff and Bad Delicious. Bike-focused activities and booths will be along the street in Heritage Square, with bike load demonstrations by Mountain Line and Metro Plan, free bike adjustments and activities by Rides in Motion, helmet fittings and bike safety tips by Absolute Bikes, handmade jewelry with a cycling twist by Velo in a Jar, bike-themed crafts for kids by Flagstaff Arts and Leadership Academy, and an open house of the cycling room at the Box Studio. Visitors can also enjoy featured art at Arizona Handmade Gallery and Fire on the Mountain, Artists Gallery, Episcopal Church of the Epiphany, The Hive, Noble Herb, West of the Moon, and Will McNabb Fine Jewelry Studio. And that was the article, Downtown Flagstaff's First Friday Art Walk to be car-free on May 2nd. The next article for today is Coconino County Gets New Trailer for Mobile Emergency Response. Coconino County Emergency Management, CCEM, debuted its new Mobile Incident Command Unit this past weekend. A rugged trailer equipped with a full suite of communications equipment to coordinate emergency operations from wherever necessary. The trailer was on display at the Highlands Fire District's Wildfire Preparedness Day on Saturday, April 26th, and CCEM staff were showing it off to visitors and to their interagency colleagues. It's purpose-built to essentially go to the most remote parts of the county, set up and operate with full power and communications, acting CCEM Director Tim Carter said. The trailer can operate off of battery power, onboard solar panels, a multi-fuel generator, or the electrical grid. It has independent suspension instead of solid axles to provide increased ground clearance and versatility for the county's many rural and Forest Service roads. "We've never really had this capability before," Carter said. "The sheriff's office has had a mobile command trailer in the past. We have never had one." To provide connectivity, the trailer has cellular and Starlink satellite internet access, multiple public safety radios with the frequencies of all partner agencies pre-programmed, and a HiFi mesh network that extends signals by piggybacking off of individual devices. And to facilitate situational awareness, the trailer features an extendable 33-foot mast topped by a camera with pan, tilt, zoom, and thermal imaging capability. A lot of historical command trailers were often the recreational RV that were then modified for public safety. "These are purpose-built by the vendor for public safety use," Carter noted. JHB Group, which specializes in mobile platforms for first responders, constructed the new mobile command center. Funding came from congressionally directed spending with the support of Arizona Senators Mark Kelly and Kristen Sinema. "It has got some amazing capabilities," CCEM business manager Nicole Harris said. "It is built to be off-road as well as on-road. It is built so that anybody with a hitch and towing capacity, of course, can haul it, so we can loan it out to be used." Carter, too, mentioned that the trailer can be loaned to partner agencies throughout the county. "This is a tool for all of our public safety partners to use," he said. The department had taken delivery of the trailer just 10 days earlier. "We're learning something new about it every day," Carter joked, and plans to deploy it for non-emergency large event oversight at Northern Arizona University's commencement and the upcoming Overland Expo West. "We've got partners already calling, wanting to reserve this thing," Carter added. And that was the article, "Coconino County Gets New Trailer for Mobile Emergency Response." You're listening to the Arizona Daily Sun, from the Flagstaff studios of Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds programming is directed to those who cannot use print material due to a disability. Listen to our live streams and learn how you can support us at the website sunsounds.org. You can also get our stream and on-demand programs with the new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android devices. The next article for today is EPA research in limbo as scientists brace for massive job cuts. As forecasters predict another year of devastating wildfires, a tool developed by Environmental Protection Agency scientists to study the health effects of hazardous smoke has been grounded by a looming Trump administration reorganization, three people familiar with the planned cuts say. Colibri, a sensor the size of a shoebox, was developed by EPA scientists to enable research not being done anywhere else in the world. It can attach to a drone, fly into smoke plumes, and measure just about any kind of airborne pollution. The future of this project and a range of other research across 50 states is at risk as EPA prepares a massive agency overhaul, which is expected to include a closure of its Office of Research and Development, ORD, according to more than a dozen EPA scientists who declined to be identified as they were not authorized to speak to media. On Thursday, EPA ORD staff received an email, which was seen by Reuters, saying there will be an all-hands meeting on Friday late afternoon. EPA said its drone program remains active, but the three sources familiar with the Colibri project said impending layoffs of key staff will halt operations. Leda Kobziar, a wildland fire science professor at the University of Idaho, praised the Colibri sensor team as global leaders in their field. "Their technology and tools play a pivotal role doing smoke research that no one else right now can do," she told Reuters. Internal documents reviewed by the U.S. House Science Committee indicate up to 75% of EPA's 1,200 Office of Research and Development staff could face layoffs, with the office's closure part of President Trump's plan to cut the agency budget by 65%. More than a dozen EPA scientists told Reuters they are operating amid anxiety and uncertainty as research has stalled across 11 offices due to slashed resources and travel. Projects affected include health risk assessments of forever chemicals like PFAS, investigations into respiratory illness in the rural South, and studies on the spread of valley fever, a fungal disease exacerbated by climate change and wildfires. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin told reporters last week that ORD reorganization plans are still being discussed. "I'm going to announce it as soon as I possibly can, but I want to make sure that it's as thoughtful as possible," he said. "This conversation isn't just about the Office of Research and Development. This is about every single office." Zeldin said he does not have a specific number goal for cutting agency staff, but the agency needs enough staff to fulfill our statutory obligations, to fulfill our core mission, and to be able to power the great American comeback. One ORD scientist who works at EPA's headquarters said it has been difficult to focus. "Every day we feel like the rug could be pulled out from underneath us," the scientist said. "Everyone feels really terrible." Another researcher based in North Carolina said research planning is on pause and the agency is taking away essential tools, such as credit cards and tech services. Some scientists working on topics under scrutiny, like environmental justice, have stopped work completely. An epidemiologist investigating air pollution in the rural South has halted work and community outreach due to exposure-related illnesses linked to a facility. "It's taken me years to build trust with these communities, and now I feel like I have to turn my back on them," the scientist said. A researcher from the Integrated Risk Information System, IRIS, said its 60-person team remains in limbo. IRIS, which assesses pollutants like PFAS and arsenic, may merge with EPA's Chemical Policy Office, threatening its independence. Potential dissolution of ORD could undermine scientific integrity and leave states ill-equipped to address public health risks, according to EPA scientists who spoke to Reuters. Jennifer Ormiz-Zavaleta, a 40-year-old EPA veteran who led ORD until 2021, said the agency's independence was preserved in prior administrations, including Trump's first term. "A centralized ORD ensures science informs multiple programs," she explained. "This administration isn't focusing on statutory requirements. It's just blowing things up," she added. And that was the article, "EPA Research in Limbo as Scientists Brace for Massive Job Cuts." The next article for today is 75% oppose Medicaid cuts, poll shows. A majority of Americans, including most Republicans, oppose major cuts in federal funding for Medicaid, according to a poll released Thursday by the nonpartisan health research organization KFF. The survey shows that 76% of those questions wouldn't support Congress slashing the amount of spending dedicated to the state federal health program for lower-income Americans and some people with disabilities. Democrats held the highest rate of opposition at 95%. A small majority of Republicans, surveyed 55%, said they don't support substantial federal spending cuts for the program. The breakdown was nearly even among respondents who identified as Make America Great Again supporters, President Donald Trump's base, with 51% of that group saying they support less federal funding for Medicaid, and 49% saying they oppose major cuts to the federal allocation. The survey comes just days before House Republicans are expected to release a bill that will likely propose cutting hundreds of billions in federal funding for Medicaid. That legislation, as well as bills from several other committees, is supposed to help Republicans offset some of the $4.5 trillion deficit impact that comes with extending the 2017 tax law. The KFF poll also shows opposition to slashing federal funding to other healthcare programs. 74% are against cuts to states for mental health and addiction prevention services. 71% didn't support reducing federal spending to track infectious disease outbreaks. 69% opposed limiting federal dollars for research at universities and medical centers. 65% were against cuts to HIV prevention program allocations, and 65% didn't support reducing federal funding to help people buy health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. Polling of 1,380 U.S. adults took place from April 8th to April 15th via telephone and online. The margin of error is plus or minus 3 percentage points. Senate GOP tracks. House action. Senate Republicans are closely watching how their House colleagues restructure federal funding for Medicaid and likely will propose changes when the entire 11-bill package comes over from the House later in 2025. Several GOP senators on Wednesday told reporters at the Capitol they will judge the package based on how changes to Medicaid will impact their constituents. Missouri Senator Josh Hawley said he's unlikely to support any changes to Medicaid that will result in cutting benefits or denying eligibility for people who are otherwise working. "I'm all for work requirements," he said. "I don't think you get any Republican objection to that." But Hawley said going beyond that might be pressing the issue too far to get his vote. "I just met with the governor of my state this morning. He's in town. We just sat down and talked about the issue," Hawley said, adding that Governor Mike Kehoe, a Republican, was very worried about potential changes to federal Medicaid funding. Maine Senator Suzanne Collins said she's planning to evaluate the House bill once it makes it through that chamber based on the impact on low-income seniors who are dual eligible, families with children with disabilities, low-income families, or rural hospitals, healthcare providers. Dual eligibility refers to people who are on Medicare and Medicaid. "I am open to carefully crafted work requirements for able-bodied adults who do not have preschool children," Collins said, "but I have no idea what the package is going to contain at this point." And that was the article. 75% oppose Medicaid cuts, poll shows. The next article for today is Waltz ousted as National Security Advisor, Rubio named interim. President Donald Trump on Thursday ousted his National Security Advisor, Mike Waltz, and named Secretary of State Marco Rubio as interim replacement, the first major shakeup of Trump's inner circle since he took office in January. Trump, in a social media post, said he would be nominating Waltz to be the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, adding that he has worked hard to put our nation's interests first. Earlier in the day, sources said Trump had decided to force Waltz out of his White House position. Trump's selection of Rubio to replace Waltz temporarily will be the first time since Henry Kissinger in the 1970s that one person held both the positions of Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. Waltz's deputy, Alex Wong, an Asia expert who was a State Department official focused on North Korea during Trump's first term, is also leaving his post, two people familiar with the matter told Reuters. Waltz, a 50-year-old former Republican lawmaker from Florida, faced criticism inside the White House when he was caught up in a March scandal involving a signal chat among top Trump national security aides. The National Security Advisor is a powerful role that does not require Senate confirmation. And that was the article, Waltz ousted as National Security Advisor, Rubio named interim. The next article for today is use of wartime law for Venezuela deportation is unlawful, judge rules. A U.S. judge on Thursday blocked President Donald Trump's administration from using an 18th century wartime law to deport some Venezuelan migrants. In a 36-page opinion, U.S. District Judge Fernando Rodriguez in Brownsville, Texas, ruled the Trump administration exceeded the scope of Alien Enemies Act by using it to speed deportation of alleged members of the Venezuela gang Tren de Aragua. The government labels the gang a terrorist organization. Trump's mid-March proclamation invoking the 1798 law to justify rapid deportations faced multiple court challenges. Judges in several states have temporarily blocked the administration from deporting migrants detained in their districts under the Alien Enemies Act, with a Colorado judge ruling last week that the administration must give migrants at least 21 days to challenge their potential removals in court. Rodriguez's ruling went further. The judge, appointed by Trump during his first term in office, permanently barred the administration from deporting Venezuelans detained in the Southern District of Texas under the law. His ruling was also the first to outright reject Trump's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act, writing that Tren de Aragua's actions in the U.S. did not amount to an invasion or predatory incursion that would justify the use of the law. The president's invocation of the AEA through the proclamation exceeds the scope of the statute and, as a result, is unlawful, wrote Rodriguez, whose district includes the detention facility from which at least 137 Venezuelan men were deported to El Salvador on March 15th, immediately after Trump invoked the law. In a statement, White House spokesman Kush Desai said Trump's election victory had given him a mandate to deport terrorist illegal aliens. The Trump administration is committed to unapologetically using every lever of power endowed to the executive branch by the Constitution and Congress to deliver on this mandate, and we are confident that we will ultimately prevail, Desai said. The administration could appeal Rodriguez's ruling to the Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, considered by many to be the most conservative of the country's 12 appellate circuits. The Alien Enemies Act is best known for being used to intern and deport people of Japanese, German, and Italian descent during World War II. Lee Gellert, a lawyer with the American Civil Liberties Union, who was representing the Venezuelan migrants, said Congress did not intend for the law to be used in the manner in which Trump has deployed it. The court critically held that the president cannot simply declare that there's been an invasion of the U.S. and then unilaterally invoke an 18th century wartime authority during peacetime, Gellert said. Relatives of many of the Venezuelan men who were deported under the law last month and their lawyers deny they were Tren de Aragua members and say the deportees were not given the chance to contest the administration's allegations. Following those deportations, the U.S. Supreme Court on April 7th ruled that the Trump administration must give migrants the chance to contest any future Alien Enemies Act deportations in court. ACLU responded by filing challenges to deportations under the law in courts around the country where Venezuelan migrants were detained. And that was the article. Use of wartime law for Venezuela deportation is unlawful, judge rules. The next article is S&P lowers GDP growth forecast after tariffs. S&P Global, a credit rating agency, lowered its global economic forecasts in response to President Donald Trump's effort to reorder global trade with tariffs. The jump in U.S. import tariffs, trading partner retaliation, ongoing concessions, and subsequent market turbulence constitute a shock to the system centered on confidence and market prices. S&P Global Ratings Global Chief Economist Paul Greenwald said, "The real economy is sure to follow, but by how much?" S&P Global cut its GDP growth forecasts for most countries. GDP, or gross domestic product, measures economic output. S&P also raised its inflation forecast for the U.S., it is not projecting a recession in the U.S. While there are increased risk to the downside across all regions, and we do anticipate a material slowdown in growth, we do not foresee a U.S. recession at this juncture, the report noted. Trump announced a slate of tariffs on April 2nd, which he later called Liberation Day for American trade. 7 days later, on April 9th, he paused nearly all of those higher rates. Trump said the pause would last 90 days, as his trade team talks with more than 75 other nations. Trump maintained a 10% baseline tariff and a 145% import duty on goods from China. He also kept tariffs on foreign-made passenger vehicles and auto parts, but Trump cushioned the blow for U.S. automakers. Tariffs on steel and aluminum also remain in place. The risks to our baseline remain firmly on the downside in the form of a stronger-than-anticipated spillover from the tariff shock to the real economy. The longer-term configuration of the global economy, including the role of the U.S., is also less certain, Grunwald said. Global growth is 0.3 percentage points lower in 2025 and 2026, relative to S&P Global's previous forecast round, and all regions are affected negatively. It lowered U.S. GDP growth by about 60 basis points over 2025 to 2026, while Canada's and Mexico's GDP growth fell by similar amounts. The report projects that Germany would take the biggest hit among the major economies. Economists, businesses, and many publicly traded companies have warned that tariffs could raise prices on a wide range of consumer products. Trump has said he wants to use tariffs to restore manufacturing jobs lost to lower-wage countries in decades past, shift the tax burden away from U.S. families, and pay down the national debt. And that was the article, S&P Lowers GDP Growth Forecast After Tariffs. The next article for today is Ban on Book Bans. Oregon bill would protect access to library materials. Oregon lawmakers are taking steps to protect access to library materials written by diverse authors or that include themes of race, gender, or sexual orientation. On April 30th, the House Education Committee heard public comments on Senate Bill 1098, which would prohibit schools and library districts from removing books with stories about religion, disability, LGBTQ+ topics, or other characteristics of a protected class in Oregon's anti-discrimination law in public education. As lawmakers across the U.S. have passed laws to restrict access to certain books and limit discussions around diversity, equity, and inclusion, Democratic Oregon lawmakers are taking steps to ensure that books by diverse authors remain accessible to readers. The bill does not remove existing standards for determining if a book is appropriate, but it adds the additional requirement that a book cannot be excluded or removed because of the perspective it represents, said bill sponsor Senator Lou Frederick from Portland. If folks only allege there's inappropriate material when that material is by or about a protected class, then that's when there's a problem, Frederick said. Public libraries and schools saw more attempts to remove books between July 2023 and 2024 than in any year since the Oregon Intellectual Freedom Clearinghouse at the State Senate Library began tracking challenges. Nearly 90% of those challenges were to books written by or about underrepresented groups, according to a letter State Librarian Wendy Cornelson submitted to lawmakers. This is the second time Frederick brings this bill to the State House. Frederick proposed a similar bill last year, which passed the Senate in a 17-12 vote, but the bill died as the five-week 2024 legislative session ended. This year's attempt passed the Senate on a party line, 18-10 vote, and awaits action in the House. Most testimony in support of bill, but Republican lawmakers call it redundant. Most of the 15 people who signed up to speak to the committee supported the bill, including several parents, an author, and representatives from the LGBTQ+ and library advocacy groups such as ACLU of Oregon and the Oregon Library Association. This bill is a tool to save Oregon schools and parents time and energy, said Bridget Tyler, a Corvallis parent. It doesn't take power away from parents. It sets limits that prevent people who don't have children in our kids' schools from interfering in our choices. Three Republican lawmakers spoke in opposition to the bill, including Senator Noah Robinson from Cave Junction, who said he is concerned that public school libraries carry inappropriate materials that are sexually explicit and have heavy profanity. Representative Emily McIntyre, R. Eagle Point, said the bill is redundant because schools already must follow non-discrimination policies. Representative Dwayne Yunker from Grants Pass said the bill would silence parents and school boards who raise concerns about education materials presented in Oregon public schools. The committee will decide whether to advance the bill during a work session at a later date. From there, it would need a vote by the full House and then head to Governor Tina Kotek, who could choose to veto the bill, sign it into law, or allow it to become law without her signature. Upon becoming law, the bill would take effect immediately. And that was the article, Ban on Book Bans. The next article is Brazil ex-president Collor faces house arrest for bribery charges. Brazil's Supreme Court has authorized former President Fernando Collor de Mello to serve house arrest after being sentenced to almost 9 years in prison on corruption and money laundering challenges, according to a court order seen by Reuters on Thursday. Collor was arrested on April 25th in Maceió after the Supreme Court rejected his challenges against a previous conviction and ordered him to start serving jail time. The top court sentenced Collor, the first president to win the popular vote after the end of Brazil's last military dictatorship in 1985, to 8 years and 10 months in prison in 2023 on corruption and money laundering charges. According to the order by Supreme Court Justice Alexandra de Moraes, Collor will wear an ankle bracelet while under house arrest. The 2023 conviction came after Brazilian prosecutors accused Collor of receiving around $5.28 million in bribes from a then subsidiary of state-run oil company Petrobras. Collor took office as president in 1990, but did not finish his term as Congress decided to impeach him 2 years later, amid a separate corruption scandal for which Supreme Court acquitted him in 1994. He later was elected as a senator representing the state of Alagoas. He left Congress in early 2023 following an unsuccessful bid for governor of Alagoas. And that was the article, Brazil ex-president Collor faces house arrest for bribery charges. The next article for today is Global Health Funding Faces Greatest Disruption in Memory, World Health Organization Director says. Global health funding faces historic challenges as donor countries reduce their contributions, the director of World Health Organization said on Thursday. United States President Donald Trump's administration withdrew from the World Health Organization upon taking office in January, saying the UN agency had mishandled the COVID pandemic and other international health crises. The United States has been by far the World Health Organization's biggest financial backer, contributing around 18% of its overall funding. We are living through the greatest disruption to global health financing in memory, Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus told reporters at the World Health Organization headquarters in Geneva. World Health Organization revised its budget downward after the U.S. withdrawal exacerbated a funding crisis caused by member states reducing their development spending. When asked by Reuters if there could be further revisions to the budget, the director general said it was not off the table as his teams continued to assess the situation. Faced with an income gap of nearly $600 million this year, the World Health Organization has proposed, slashing its budget for 2026 to 27 by 21%, from $5.3 billion to $4.2 billion, and reducing staff numbers, according to an internal memo seen by Reuters in March. "It is, of course, very painful," the director said, warning that the cuts would have a significant impact on the health of people around the world. The World Health Organization says it is looking at making savings at the regional, headquarters, and country level. It will reduce jobs at its headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland, as well as closing some country offices in higher and upper income countries, said Tedros. A quarter of the World Health Organization's salary costs are not met for the next 2 years, said the World Health Organization's Assistant Director General of Business Operations, Raul Thomas. He said it is not yet possible to say how many staff will be cut, as it will depend on the grade and location of people identified in its cost-saving measures. Tedros also said the World Health Organization wants to move towards broadening its donor base, acknowledging it faced a structural problem whereby it is over-reliant on voluntary contribution, which account for 80% of the World Health Organization's total budget, coming from a few donors. Tedros told Reuters that he has not had direct contact with U.S. President Donald Trump, but is in touch with his administration and is providing information and answering their questions. And that was the article, "Global Health Funding Faces Greatest Disruption in Memory," the World Health Organization director says. That's all the time we have for the Arizona Daily Sun. For Sun Sounds of Arizona and Flagstaff, I'm volunteer reader Julia. Thanks for listening.